light feel to it. I actually feel cooler now. Not like a Fonzie cooler, physically cooler. Wasn't that just light, refreshing? It's refreshing. Well, I know we're all looking forward to the Feast of Tabernacles, and by no means do I want to overlook the two holy days that precede it, Trumpets and Atonement. But sometimes we focus so much on Trumpets and Atonement and prepping for them, we're left with very little time to cover specific feast preparation. And I think at least this, in concept, this will cover both, all of them, but mostly the feast. It's called the feast for a reason. Second tithe is quite a gift, isn't it? I mean, when I first heard about having to save second tithe, I about choked. Probably many of you did as well. But you just do it, and it all works out. You don't have to kind of figure it out. Back then, they had spreadsheets, but they weren't the kind that were on computers. They were actually literally spreadsheets. And I remember trying to fill one out. First tithe, second tithe, third tithe, how's this all going to work? And I spent hours on that. I just couldn't make it work. And someone just told me, forget all that. Just do it. And you just do it, and it all works out. Well, second tithe is actually, when the feast time rolls around, it's an amazing gift. It's one-tenth of our annual income to spend in just 8 days. Now, we could take some of that, and we use it on other holy days throughout the year, but for the most part, it's meant for the feast. For 1 week, we get to live at a level of income and wealth nearly five times greater than what we normally live day to day. Do the math. It all works out. In Deuteronomy 14 is that command. And I love, this is one of the most, for those of us who think that the life of a Bible believer is drudgery and difficult, and that God is harsh and exacting, I like to remember this verse. This is Deuteronomy 14, verses 22 through 16. I'm sorry, 22 through 26. Deuteronomy 14, 22. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide. We talked about what that meant last year. The tithe of your grain and your new wine and your oil, of the firstborn of your herds and your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. But if the journey is too long for you so that you are not able to carry the tithe, or if the place where the Lord your God chooses to put his name is too far for you, then when the Lord your God has blessed you, then you shall exchange it for money. Take the money in your hand and go to the place which the Lord your God chooses, and you shall spend that money on whatever your heart desires. That's a pretty open-ended statement, isn't it? I mean, for a God that's supposed to be exacting and harsh and strict and, well, you better do, toe the line. You shall spend that money, that tithe money, the second tithe that is his money, it's a tithe that belongs to him, but we were saving it specifically for the reason, on whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep, for wine or similar drink, or whatever your heart desires. You shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. I mean, it's specifically given to us to enhance our rejoicing before him. By God's design, he wants us to spend it, and that statement again, whatever our hearts desire. Whatever, in the King James, I think it says, whatever our soul lusts after. Now, that's pretty broad. As we actually understand that and recognize, and I hope by the end of this message we'll recognize that that has much more meaning to it than what at least the carnal side of us thinks it means. There is something that happens to us when we first read that. This kind of sudden wealth can play very funny tricks on our minds and influencing the way that we think and prepare for the day. If we aren't careful, it can turn into something that God designed to be a joyous and fulfilling experience for us, a celebration, into a very hollow and empty experience. The Jews kind of understood this, keeping the feast for a number of years, a millennia actually. The Jews understood this concept, and they developed a tradition that helped them to have some kind of perspective prior to the Feast of Tabernacles each year. They would read the book of Koheleth. How many here know that book? Well, you do. That's the Jewish term for it. It's actually the book of Ecclesiastes. Though its message is much broader in scope than just the Feast of Tabernacles, in Ecclesiastes, they found a message that gave them perspective and balance before their festivity. I want to kind of review that for us today to help us as we approach these fall holy days. What was it that inspired the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes that can help us in keeping the Feast of Tabernacles today? Let's go there. Book of Ecclesiastes. It follows Proverbs. Book of Ecclesiastes. Literally, the word Koheleth, the Jewish term Koheleth, means the words of the preacher, or words coming from the preacher. And that's was turned into Ecclesiastes in the translation here. Many feel that this book is one of the most puzzling books in the Old Testament. It is considered by some to be incredibly melancholy, very negative, even depressing. And really, it's the perspective by which we read it that makes it that way for some. For others, they see great understanding in this, great wisdom that can be applied in this age. Now, Jewish and early Christian tradition obviously attributes this to Solomon, written about 945 B.C. There's certain references we see right in verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king Jerusalem, obvious references to wisdom throughout the book, building activities and wealth and so on, in the position of a king. It's obviously attributed to Solomon and Solomon's writings. Same style almost as the book of Proverbs, or many of the Proverbs in the book of Proverbs as well. He was son of David, king in Jerusalem, and there are other references that will help us to nail that down. I don't think that's debated here. It is, in fact, some commentaries would say, a dramatic autobiography of Solomon's experiences and observations, most likely while he was alienated from God. Wasn't that way initially? When you read about God's approach to Solomon as David's son, starting back when Solomon was born, God had a tremendous affection for Solomon and opened up many doors for him, blessed him immeasurably. Was really pleased when he became king and God asked him, saying, what do you want? Tell me what you want. And he says, what I need is wisdom to help rule these people and help lead them. And he was so pleased with that he gave him that plus much more. So there was a time when Solomon had a great relationship with God. But as you read through the book of Ecclesiastes, you see where he kind of got off track. Not specifically, but you see his reactions to it. And this would explain some reoccurring themes in the book. And they're introduced right immediately. Verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Well, that's vanity five times in a short sentence. Vanity. This word is translated from the Hebrew word hebel. It's spelled H-E-B-E-L. It occurs 35 times in the book, in 29 different verses in the book. It means futility. It means uselessness. It means nothingness. This is the design of the book. And it leads him into a specific purpose statement, which we'll read in a bit later. But it's actually the design of the book, the focus of the book. To live without understanding, to live specifically without understanding of who he was, of where he came from, of why he was here, of what he was supposed to be doing here and where he was going, was empty. It was futile. It was meaningless. What do I do here now? And what is all this work I do and everything I'm experiencing now? Why does this have any meaning for where I'm going? Because at the time, and you'll see this as we go further, at the time he saw everything ending in the grave. In short, Solomon did not know what we covered in the Feast of Pentecost. He did not know true freedom. He did not know what he was meant to be. And apart from God, he couldn't know it. That's the design of the book. Let's read verses 3 through 9 now. We'll see kind of the another statement that comes up right in verse 4, I believe. Verse 3. What profit has man from all his labor which he toils under the sun? This is the perspective of the book. This is how Solomon is viewing things. And it's really important for those who are reading, especially led by the Spirit of God, not to get depressed as Solomon does, because he did not have the understanding and the perspective that we have. He was under the sun. I was noticing this the other day. Our planet is so tiny, so small within space. But how much time, brethren, do we actually spend looking up? Especially us, when we know we're going to inherit all of creation. We're still downward focused. That's all about the earth. It's all about the trees. It's all about our house. It's all about our jobs. It's about driving, getting back and forth to work. It's all the stuff that we do apart from the Feast of Tabernacles, but it's easy to draw all this stuff into the feast and miss that focus. Look up. Look at the entirety of the creation. Get away from the big city on a clear fall night and look up at the Milky Way and see the vastness of space and feel how small we are and how big God wants us to be. This is what Solomon was not seeing here. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continuously and comes again on its circuit. Everything goes around in circles. Everything keeps getting repeated over and over again. There's nothing new. Verse 7, all the rivers run to the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. This phrase is actually one word, shemesh. It's translated from one Hebrew word, shemesh, S-H-E-M-E-S-H, shemesh. It occurs 29 times in the book in 27 different verses. And it suggests, again, an earthly point of view, not a spiritual view, a physical, carnal, intelligent mind, still trying to grasp with an understanding of something bigger and broader than just this world. This is, the perspective of the book, the viewpoint of Solomon and all men, again, apart from God. In verses 11 through 12, it begins kind of a prologue here. And in verse 14 is the specific purpose statement. Let's begin reading in verse 10, though. He says, is there anything of which may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. I look at the mindset of humanity today, so steeped in hubris, in arrogance. And I think a lot of this fits into the evolutionary mindset. I think Andy covered some of this a few weeks ago. The idea of evolution, that things just keep getting better. No matter how bad they are or how they appear, things just keep getting better. We're learning so many new things. We've got so many fun toys. Technology just keeps moving us forward, and it's going to solve everything for us. You know, it's the new god of man, technology. Solomon there is saying, though, there's nothing new. Nothing new under the sun. You want new? You've got to have a different perspective. Verse 12. He says, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised. Life was a burden to him because he didn't know what he was meant to become. And verse 14, if there's a specific purpose statement here, this comes close. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be numbered. I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness. I have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this was also a grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases in knowledge increases in sorrow. This document that he wrote here, this book, is an effort to discover meaning in life. It's a record of Solomon's observations and his experiments, his testing. And you'll see, and we'll cover some of this, there are certain basic human philosophies that he brings out that are still existent today and rampant today that try to give some meaning and purpose to life, but they all fall short from their perspective. this specific purpose statement here, this is the aim of the book. The book aims to search for a life's meaning, a purpose for human existence from various human concepts apart from God. And we can see how they unfold. And chapter 2 is the first one. And really what's summarized throughout all of this chapter is a focus on hedonism, the pursuit of pleasure as giving meaning to life. Laughter, we need to be entertained. We need to be always be happy. We always need to be laughing and smiling and exuberant and joyful. We need wine. You need to have wine to really enjoy life. You need to have possessions. You need to have lots of things. You really do. Or life is not joyful. There's no meaning unless we've got possessions. You need to have servants, he talks about in this chapter. Servants, people waiting on you hand and foot. There has to be music. And you know, I was thinking about this the other day too. Of all generations, we are so much surrounded by music today. It's like always on, wherever you go. Into a store, in your car, you turn it on. People are wearing these headsets. Music is on our phones. You get into an elevator and you hear music. Well, something that sounds like music. But it's everywhere. Stores, you try it on clothes, you hear music going on in the background. And you know what? I know this from my marketing background. That music is specifically designed to get you to buy things. There are certain songs, certain things they can play, certain beats, certain rhythms that put you in a certain mood that, yeah, I can afford this. Here's my card. But and that's one of the reasons I think we're so surrounded and inundated with it. And you know what it does? It creates an entitlement nature within us. I am entitled to music. I should have music on my phone. I should be wearing a headset all the time until I go deaf. I should have music when I go into a store. Hey, where's the music? It's like something we deserve. Well, of all the generations that went before us, did they have this? I mean, Farmer Brown in 1750 had music playing all the time when he was riding his, it wasn't a tractor, it would have been a mule and his plow through the fields. But now, boy, now it's all over the place. And here's the other thing. When they had music, because they didn't have it all the time, when somebody pulled out a mandolin or a guitar or a banjo and started singing, that was something special. And boy, when someone could play piano and they could fill the house with music, that was incredible. Now I wonder, you know, do we take it for granted? It is a blessing, but does it give meaning to life? Look at verses 11 through 10 here. Actually, did we finish verse 1? I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Actually, we didn't even start it. Let's start it. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Yeah, and you're going to smile when I say this word, but it's only because it's changed in the past 50 years. Gaiety. This is gaiety. Therefore, enjoy pleasure, but surely this also was vanity. Verse 2, I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven until the days of their lives. And we go on there. Let's just skip to verses 10 and 11 here to see the result of that pursuit. I guess this is more from my generation. The phrase, if it feels good, do it. If it feels good, do it. Nike may have shortened that into just do it. That mentality, though, in my generation has led to this generation to a certain sense of recklessness and almost irresponsible imbalance within my generation. And it seems to be holding on. Self-indulgence and excess in so many things that Christ said would exist right to the very end. As in the days of Noah, they would be eating and drinking and giving in marriage right to the end, not seeing what was happening around them. Verses 10 and 11. Whatever my eyes, Solomon said, whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my reward from all my labor. As we should. We should see our tithe for all the opportunities for labor and earning things that God has given us in the past year. It's part of counting our blessings. Verse 11. Then I looked on all the works that my hand had done, on the labor which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. The focus here is profit more so than the actual busyness of labor. What was gleaned from it? Was any meaning for life taken from it? From all that self-indulgence that he put himself through? All the excess in eating, drinking, entertainment, and to some degree debauchery of every kind. This is what our society is presently enslaved in. And for those of you who have been born into this generation, you may not notice it unless you look at it in the context of Scripture and in the context of history. We have incredible wealth today, but it has not always been like this. This is a relatively short expanse of time. Appreciate all that you have. That should be a mindset at the feast. Many have been enslaved today because of this focus in habits and in addictions that are killing them and robbing their lives of whatever meaning and purpose they had in the first place. Solomon went through this, and he concluded, this is not the way to true meaning in life. In verse 12, we receive the second thing that he approaches here. He says, "Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly in contrast. For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly, as light excels darkness." So he started focusing on kind of educating himself. Knowledge, wise decisions, careful, intelligent planning. That's what gives meaning to life. If you have a very methodical approach to life, A plus B plus C, you will reach D. Well, he didn't reach it. But he attempted it. He looked for it in education, in degrees of learning. Let's read verses 14 through 17. "The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceived that the same event happens to them all." As we go through this, you may think, well, because this doesn't give meaning to life, then there's no value to knowledge and wise decisions. Absolutely not. We're blessed to have knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. Just as we are blessed to have all the other things we're talked about here, wine and music and laughter and houses and possessions of herds and flocks, special treasures, musical instruments of all kinds, singers. He mentioned all those prior to this. Those are blessings for us, and we should take advantage of them. But he couldn't find any meaning in them. He couldn't find a reason for his existence, a purpose for his life. And he's seeing this now even in the things that he is learning. We can do the same thing, brethren, even with spiritual knowledge. We can think that what's going to give us understanding and wisdom and meaning in life is to learn everything we possibly can about the Scriptures. Study them, which we should do. Memorize them, which in some cases we should do. But the meaning that is in them is actually learned and understood in their application, not just in the knowledge. I think Paul said that, I think it's 1 Corinthians 8:1, "Knowledge puffs up, love edifies, love builds up." Knowledge only means something in application of love. And that takes a view above the sun to understand. Human wisdom, knowledge, wise decisions does not bring a meaning to life. Let's go to verse 15 again now. "So I said in my heart, as it applies to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this is also vanity." Have you ever done things perfectly? Well, nobody has. But you strived for them. You did everything that you were supposed to do. You followed your parents' counsel. You followed your teacher's counsel. You got all straight A's. You worked hard. But all of a sudden, the guy living next door to you in a much bigger, nicer house who won the lottery has more than you do and didn't do any of that. You ever wonder about that? I often wonder about this. I see people that I would never have hired when I was working in telecommunications. Just for the way they, and it's probably a bad statement, just for the way they dressed, I couldn't have somebody with hair down the middle of their back and tattoos all over their faces and piercings so much that they couldn't even talk. Just jammed into like their lower lip, where their lip just kind of hung down. And they're incredibly unkempt and dirty, and they smell. And I watch these people, and they're driving around in Harleys. I can't afford a Harley. My wife wouldn't let me get one anyway. But I who could afford a Harley? They go $20,000-$30,000 in some cases. And what are they doing? I'm working, and they're out driving around and going places and going to bars and cookouts and where is that money coming from? They're working somehow, some way. But you ever wonder, so you did, you tried to stay clean cut and clean shaven, and you did all the right things, and you strived to do the best that you could throughout your life, and now the end result is the same for anybody else who took whatever tack they took? This is Solomon's looking at it now. He tried to do everything right as he grew up as a boy, and now he's king over Israel. But he's looking at other kings that have more or in same situations as him that didn't do all those things, and he's wondering. In verses 13 through 17 here, he's talking about that work. Let's go to 16. He says, "For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever. Both end in the grave." It doesn't really matter. Even if the person isn't living next door to you in wealth and happiness and so on, you're both going to end up in a grave at some point in time. There are people who smoke, brethren, who will outlive us. Okay? That's just the way it happens sometimes. Does that mean smoking is okay? Does it mean it doesn't damage your body, hurt your body? Is it exemplifying the same kind of self-indulgence that we see in the society around us that the scriptures warn us of? "For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? As the fool. Therefore I hated life because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind." Again, he reiterates his perspective. What does work accomplish? What does all the diligence accomplish? In terms of enterprise, achievement, I mean, statement here versus workaholics. Verses 17 through 26, he talks about this. Let's go through that. We're not going to review the entire book, but the beginning portion of it gives us an understanding that helps us understand the rest of it. And I would encourage all of you to read this prior to the Feast of Tabernacles. Study it. We'll lay a foundation for it, and you'll see how the book lays out. Verse 17. "Therefore I hated life because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all is vanity and a grasping for the wind." When we read Solomon's comments here, brethren, and you will see this as well, because we are led by the Spirit of God, we understand his plan, we know what we were meant to be, we have been given the greatest of treasures. Here's one of the most wise and wealthy men that have ever lived. And he was frustrated, even to the point of wanting to die, because he didn't know what we know. He didn't know who he was, where he came from, and where he was going. Verse 18, "Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me." He's still going to die. And everything that he had done, all the effort that he had put in, all the work that he had put in to building all these things, to gathering all this wealth, was going to go to someone who had no stake in it, who didn't build it up at all, and may not even appreciate it. Verse 19, "And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity, emptiness. It's meaningless. Therefore I turned my heart and despaired of all the labor which I had toiled under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, yet he must leave his heritage to a man who has not labored for it. This also is vanity and a great evil." Great evil. "For what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night his heart takes no rest." He wrote elsewhere that God gives his beloved sleep. Or that he also wrote that dreams come from the multitude of business. Was all he had developed, all he had generated, all he had done keeping him up at night, probably. Verse 24, "Nothing is better for a man that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God." This phrasing, "nothing better than you should eat and drink and enjoy," leads to an attitude that is rampant in the world today. It actually circumvents the work of God, and we'll expand on it a bit later. Verse 25, "For who can eat, or who can have enjoyment more than I? For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight, but to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Work is not the answer, no matter how hard we labor, no matter how much we accomplish. But the idea that educating ourselves, growing in knowledge and wisdom to kind of enhance that work and what that work can produce is rampant with our culture. And it's actually developed by the Apostle Paul in Romans 1. In Romans 1, he talks about individuals professing to be wise, yet becoming fools. Learning things, but all the wrong things. Having the wrong perspective from the outset. This is Romans 1, verse 22. That belief persists to this day. That education is somehow the holy grail. We will solve everything within our society. All we need to do is educate everybody. All we need to do is teach them. That will somehow solve all of society's ills. Well, Solomon was learning this. We know how far he got. But this doesn't happen apart from God. Look at chapter 3 here now. This is a really interesting chapter because he's actually comparing here two human philosophical concepts that are alive and well today, one more than the other. Fatalism, which is the belief that everything is predetermined. Nothing can be done to change anything. Nothing can be added to it. Whatever you do, you're going to be locked into a certain path, and no matter what, nothing's going to happen. So why do anything? Fatalism. The other one is existentialism. And I don't profess to be able to explain to you what existentialism is. I do know an existentialist joke. How many existentialists does it take to change a light bulb? Banana. Now, see, I think that's hilarious. I knew everybody would go whoosh. Well, that's what existentialism does. It goes whoosh. In fact, I heard somebody say that if you think you know what existentialism is, you're not doing it right. Because it involves so many odd different concepts. But in essence, existentialism is the belief that our outcomes, whatever we do in life, is simply determined by how we choose to react to certain inevitable experiences in life. And those choices could be anything. It kind of removes all sense of group morality or universal law, because everything is just choices. Your reality is simply what you want it to be, you know, what your thinking makes it. Again, I don't think that does it justice to describe it that way, but you can look into it if you want to. It's kind of a black hole, I'll warn you. You'll get sucked into it. Solomon goes through this here, and this is a very famous poem. It was put to music back in the 60s, and as I read it, I'll want to sing it. I'll save you that pain, though. To everything there is a season. This is Ecclesiastes 3:1. To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to pluck what is planted. A time to kill, and a time to heal. A time to break down, and a time to build up. A time to weep, and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to gain, a time to lose, a time to keep, a time to throw away, a time to tear, and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. In all this, great wisdom to understand that these experiences happen to everyone and to have the discernment to recognize the time that we are in, the occasion, the place, how to act, how to dress, how to handle it when it comes, how to prepare for it. And all these things, Solomon discounts that life is predetermined, and he states, in not so uncertain terms throughout this chapter, that our future is chosen for us, but not in a sense where all of our choices determine it in terms of its end. So God has a plan and a purpose that he was not seeing here. So existentialism, making your own choices, is determining your own way. He's deliberating that life is indiscriminate and that our outcomes, again, are simply determined by how we choose to react to certain experiences, inevitable experiences that everyone goes through in life. Someone once said that all we can really trust in is our own reaction to events, to existence, thus the word existentialism, that existing precedes our essence. This is what is completely lost in human philosophy. We don't understand our essence apart from God. Let's read verses 9 through 11 here. He reaches his conclusion. What profit has the worker from that which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. No one can find that out. You can see that this approach led him to a very frustrating mindset, that though he had the power to choose, he had free moral agency, he was powerless to affect his surroundings. Something is being worked out here. That's why we go through these life's experiences. But for what? He didn't know. He didn't understand. Thus, this paradox that most of humanity is in. And whenever we bury someone, we tend to think about this. We talked about this a bit briefly yesterday at Ron's memorial service. Typically, human beings don't even think about the idea they're going to die because it's so morbid to them and so confusing, like for Solomon, that they don't approach it until actually they're faced with it, either their own or a loved one's. And this is the paradox. We are in a temporary physical existence. But as Solomon said here, there is an innate longing within us for eternity. And some translations say for the world, for everything. We want to be more because we're designed to be more. And that resides within our hearts. Those who don't see that or get that, don't understand it, are locked into the same hopelessness that Solomon was fighting through. In chapter 4 now, he refers to work again, but not so much from the standpoint of profit, the standpoint of popularity. Boy, look at him. Look at all he's accomplished. Look at what he's done. It has more to do with how others view that work. Let's read verses 4 through 8 here in chapter 4, and we'll start skipping through some of this. This is Ecclesiastes 4, verse 4. Again, I saw that for all the toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Not the work itself, but seeking to be envied by your neighbor or even envying somebody else's work or accomplishment. Verse 5, the fool folds his hand and consumes his own flesh. Better a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. Then I returned, and I saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone, without companion. He has neither son nor brother, yet there is no end to all his labors. Nor is his eye satisfied with riches, but he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. Just stuck in work, working to gain the praise of others, working because that is what they think brings them meaning to life, what they accomplish, seeking to work and gain lots of friends through that, relationships, gaining fame, gaining distinction, gaining esteem from what is accomplished and what is done. And again, he concludes in verses 13 through 16 on this point. Better a poor and wise youth than an old foolish king who will be admonished no more. For he comes out of prison to be king. Although he was born in his kingdom, I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king, yet those who will come after will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. So forget about the one who gave us all the peace in this kingdom, who built all these things for us, all this infrastructure. Now we like this guy. He's the flavor of the month, not this other guy. So all the effort to please others, to be liked by others, to help others, to accomplish things for others also was vanity. Popularity in this age is fleeting. Fame is fleeting. Even in the workplace, I saw this for many years, the attitude of, what have you shown me lately? You know, no matter what you did last week, you may have gotten a reward for it, you may have been promoted for it, you may have gotten a raise for whatever you accomplished that week, last week, that was wonderful. You're the flavor of the month. It all disappears next month. Because that's the structure of the economy and business. What have you done for me lately? And that's even from the standpoint of customers. Oh, I bought good things from you, in years past, but, what do you got for me now? Because I'll go to I have no loyalties here, I'll go to whomever to get what I want. Businesses know that, they develop the same kind of approach. That attitude has driven and ended many careers. What have you done for me lately? Blind followers and, forgive the term, brown nosers are an easily replenished pool. In chapter 5 now, the next thing he approaches is religion. But not religion from the standpoint of true, honest integrity, application and belief, truth in love. It's the trappings of religion. It's the outward things of religion. It's the things we do and are seen by others. He says, walk prudently when you go to the house of God and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know they do evil. Do not be rash with your mouth. Do not let your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven and you on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. For a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his words. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? All those things are great advice for approaching God on any level, whether we are his son or hope to be. Verse 7. For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there is also vanity. But fear God. Fear God. Outward trappings, ceremony and routine will not lead to meaning in life. We have to keep in mind here, though, as he's viewing this and he's viewing his relationship with God, he still understands to fear God, to respect God for who he is. He sees God as the creator of the universe. That's not lost in any of this. He fears him from the standpoint of a king being put in that position, from all he was taught from his father and from all that Israel was practicing at the time. But his relationship with God was not as a son to a father. There was something missing there. His relationship was as one in the house, but not in the home. There was a lack of understanding of God's mercy, his kindness, that yes, there's a time when God wants to hear from us. He wants to hear us singing praises to him. He wants to hear special music pieces played by us and our children. He wants us to pray. He wants us to fellowship and talk to one another. He listens to that. He says so in Malachi. He's involved in those discussions, especially as his very essence is in each one of us. And though we see it here with 100, 120 in attendance, you see it in many, many ways at the Feast of Tabernacles, 2, 3, 4, 500, 1,000 in some places. And it seems the more that are there, the more obvious it is sometimes. But oftentimes I have found it's the smaller feast sites, 100, 150, even smaller, where you have a week set aside by God in a place where he's put his name, where we gather together in such intimacy, when you leave those people, it usually happens overseas in smaller areas, you really feel like you're leaving a brother in Christ. I mean, you truly, it's almost hurtful, the separation. That's not what he's talking about here, though. He doesn't understand that perspective above the sun. He's seeing it on physical human terms. James talks about this in James 1, verse 27. He talks about true religion and what it means. It's caring for the widows and the orphans in their distress and their hurt and pain. as many of us did yesterday, and keeping oneself unspotted from the world. But for what purpose and reason, as we understand it, Solomon did not know. True religion is not obvious. Caring for orphans and widows and keeping oneself unspotted from the world most often go unnoticed. They're quiet. They're personal. But what he's talking about here are the outward show, the trappings of it all. He found no meaning in them. Look at verse 10. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This is also vanity. Now, in this chapter, he's specifically addressing wealth, riches, and property. Kind of the concept of he who dies with the most toys wins. I've seen that bumper sticker. Some of those people that first put those bumper stickers on their cars or trucks are now dead. So they're no longer in that race. And maybe that's, you know, merciful to them. Anyone here love wine? I mean, when I was younger, I became part of a California wine club where they sent me two bottles of wine a month. It was fairly inexpensive, but it was good wine, and I wanted to kind of sample it, taste it, but I also wanted to build a kind of a reserve. This is, you know, prior to losing my job and not being able to afford it anymore, but I started trying to save this wine. Well, you know what? It didn't work. Because every bottle I get, I would drink, and I would have friends over, and we would have a dinner, and it would go. I was not able to save any wine at all, even though I got two bottles a month for a year. Actually, probably more than a year. But it wasn't able. If you love silver, if you love wealth and riches, you won't have wealth and riches. Why? Because you'll spend it. You'll spend it on whatever your heart desires all year long, and you won't have money left. If you truly love money, you'd become, you know, one of those Scrooge guys, you know, these guys that hoard everything and don't spend a dime or a penny and, you know, nickel and dime everyone they meet, if you truly love money. He's telling us here, he who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. So no matter how much you collect of what you love, it will not satisfy you. Nor is he who loves abundance with increase. This is also vanity. Wealth, riches, property doesn't work. Look at verses 11 through 17. Look what it generates. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their own eyes? This is not just employees. These are individuals who recognize you because, hey, you're wealthy. You've got things. You ever read about people who win the lottery and how relatives, distant relatives they never even knew existed, come like out of the woodwork and need a hernia operation or something like that? And look, you just won $10 million. All I need is $50,000. Can't you just help me with... I mean, are you so cruel that you won't give me money for something that's really I need? This is what happens. As wealth increases, those who eat that wealth, who take it from you, come out of the woodwork. Verse 12, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet. So you go to sleep at night, I've accomplished something, I got done what I wanted to do, your mind's at peace and at ease, you go to sleep. Whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. Why? Because everybody wants what I've got. They want my cars, they want my business. They want my money in the bank. Everybody, from the government to the guys standing out in front of my building asking for money every morning, everybody wants my money. So I've got to find ways to protect it, to keep it. Verse 13, there is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to his own hurt. To his own hurt. Riches. But those riches perish through misfortune, or in some translations will say bad business, bad decisions. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked he shall return to go as he came. And he shall take nothing from his labor which he may carry away in his hand. And this is also a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit has he who has labored for the wind? I don't know what you can stuff in your casket when you die. You'll be able to use it at all. I know Egyptian kings used to be buried with all their great possessions, their animals and so on, or at least symbols of them. But they're still dead. Verse 17, all his days he also eats in darkness, because he doesn't want people to see what he's got, because they'll come and take it. And he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. It eats us up. Worry and fear that misfortune may befall me. And this is what Solomon is saying. Misfortune itself is a great evil. We should be able to keep what we make, shouldn't we? Well, it depends on how free your society is. Let's read verses 1 through 2 in chapter 6. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that he lacks nothing for himself of all he desires. Now, how could that be an evil? Yet God does not give him the power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity, and it is an evil affliction. It gets taken away. Eventually, everything we have will get taken away. And often, riches control the rich. The more we have, the bigger a target we become. The more time we spend caring for, adding to, and defending what we have. And Solomon here may have been referring to himself. I know you've probably heard this statement before, but my father said it when I was a boy. He bought a boat. And we were not well off when we were young. And the idea that any of us could own a boat, that was like the epitome of richness. It wasn't a yacht. It was a used speedboat, but it was a boat. And we went on lakes for a couple of years. We used to vacation in Maine where my mother grew up, my stepmother grew up. And there were a lot of lakes up there, and we would go water skiing, and it was a blast. But then the boat became this burden. It's a lot to take care of. If you have boats, you know, you've got to take care of them, right? And that becomes kind of a burden. And then the kids grow up and they don't go water skiing anymore, and you don't have as many opportunities, and the boat just sits there in the garage, and it gets tougher and tougher and tougher. My dad said, I heard him told a friend this once, he said, the two happiest days of my life were the day I bought my boat and the day I sold my boat. Just the way it goes. If we're really honest and look at our wealth and possessions, we see that's what happens. Look at verses 7 through 12 here. All the labor of man, this is chapter 6, verse 7, all the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the soul is not satisfied. For what more has the wise man than the fool? What does the poor man have who knows how to walk before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desire. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Whatever one is, he has been named already, for it is known that he is man. See, he's touching on something here that just skirts along the idea, the concept, the plan of God, but he can't grasp it under the sun. And he cannot contend with him, though such that him is in capital form with respect to God, who is mightier than he. Since there are many things that increase vanity, how is man the better? For who knows what is good for man in life? All the days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow, who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? After this, Solomon begins to get a little bit more practical, less philosophical. He begins to wonder why anyone would wander about looking for meaning when none can be found, unless God imparts the knowledge of it. And the next four chapters are kind of a connected thesis, examining the kind of common sense approach to life. Solomon may have this time been much older, and in his life he may have cultivated an indifference to events and what was happening around him. At least that's what some say, the commentaries. Chapter 7, I'll just give you a summary of chapter 7. And it begins the summary. And then he talks about how to live amidst such futility. It's sort of a concentrated version of the book of Proverbs. Why he was focused on wisdom. Why he needed to understand things, knowledge of things, so he could avoid the pitfalls of life and so on. Laced throughout chapter 7 is an exhortation to aim for a happy medium. Stay balanced. Stay balanced. Don't take risks. Don't go to any extremes. And you see that even in the book of Proverbs. This approach, though, leads to a very bland, very listless existence for those under the sun. Chapter 8, he advises the reader to master human power structures, not just governments, but those who apply certain things and gain power from it. He's trying to understand here who is an authority and who isn't. And he's advising us to be on the side of the one who is in power, who is in authority, that will give us opportunity in life. Understand who's in charge and make sure that you're on the right side. The problem with this is those power structures are always changing. Always changing. Under the sun. The power structure above the sun doesn't change. In chapter 9, he talks about human value judgments. A lot of it leading to some philosophical thought, again, that is largely driving much of our culture today. But those human values, the things that humans put value on and thereby make judgments by them, they don't always work. A plus B should equal C, but it doesn't always. Under the sun. Above the sun, those value judgments, spiritual, godly value judgments, are always of value, of the greatest of value. In chapter 10, he closes here with an exhortation to remain discreet in life. Maintain discretion as you live. Be temperate. Be diligent. Be cautious. This leads to a very safe existence, but still, in and of itself, without meaning under the sun. You may never make any mistakes in this life in terms of business and choices and decisions and so on, even if you achieve that. Means nothing under the sun. Solomon examines other philosophies and concepts throughout the book. You can read it. But he throws each one out as a source for meaning in life. Again, we have to note this, though. His examination, as he pens it down here, even to the end, consistently, Solomon's perspective does not change in all of his human evaluations, in all of his physical views of what's going on around him. Therefore, his results remain the same. And the lesson stands, the lesson of the book. No physical pursuit of itself can produce any meaning for life. Purpose for human existence cannot be found under the sun. Look at chapter 11 and verse 8 here. Chapter 11, verse 8. But if a man lives many years and rejoices in them all, yet let him remember the days of darkness, for there will be many. All that is coming is vanity. It's hopeless. It's useless. It's futility. Again, pursuits of happiness in this age are not wrong of themselves, but none should be the focus of life. And it's a critical mindset to have as we approach the fall holy days. Six times in this book, Solomon admonishes those who pursue these ends for meaning. He tells them this: eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. There are some individuals who approach the Feast of Tabernacles this way. I know I used to. I used to think there was nothing at the end of the Feast of Tabernacles, that it was this big blowout party, and I wasn't coming back to the real world. And afterwards, I went through this massive post-feast depression. I don't know if anybody else went through that, at least initially as I started out. My family was not in the church. I wasn't reared in the church. So when I saw this incredible party at the end, I'm a natural peacock anyway. You want me to do anything, put a party at the end. Well, that's what God did. He put this massive party at the end of his holy day cycle. But we have to be temperate about it, and we have to temper it with the plan of God. Six times Solomon says this. I'll give you these verses. Where he says, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That in and of itself is a great evil. We'll talk about that in a moment. Chapter 2, verse 24. Chapter 3, verse 13 and verse 22. Chapter 5, verse 18. Chapter 8, verse 15. And chapter 9, verse 7. He mentions that all those times. Paul, the Apostle Paul, used this in the resurrection chapter. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 32. And it uses it in a very negative context when he's comparing the trials of this age, the things that he had gone through, to the joy of our coming resurrection. If there is no chance that we will become what we were meant to be, then blow it out. Exhaust every pleasure in this age, regardless of the outcome. But that wasn't Paul's point. He said, if there is no resurrection, if there is no chance of becoming who we were meant to be, then we might as well. But his faith and ours, brethren, could never allow that. This is an attitude God is not pleased with. Look at Isaiah 22 here. Isaiah chapter 22, verses 12 through 14. Isaiah 22, verse 12. And in the day, this is interesting as we approach the day of the Lord God of hosts, and we're approaching the holy day that points to the day of the Lord. And in that day, the Lord God of hosts called for weeping. Notice this now. He wanted them to weep and for mourning for what they had done. He wanted repentance and change. For baldness and for girding with sackcloth, approach him. Pray for repentance. Pray for change because of the evil that had been done. Verse 13. But instead, joy and gladness. Slaying oxen and killing sheep. You see this in the attitude of our own country. We're so deeply in debt, so deeply in hock, we'll never get out of it. We are morally decaying. We are the leader of immorality in the world. We push it, and the world knows it. This is where we live, brethren. But instead, joy and gladness. Oh, nothing's wrong. Everything's fine. Go out to dinner. Eat something. Buy something. Go to a store. Keep the economy going. Spend all the wealth that you've been given. But instead, joy and gladness, slaying oxen and killing sheep, eating meat and drinking wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Verse 14. Then it was revealed in my hearing by the Lord of hosts, surely for this iniquity. What iniquity? This attitude. This refusal to repent. And this mindset, that this scorched earth mindset, you know what I'm referring to there? At the end of World War II, when Hitler knew he was losing, instead of surrendering and sparing his people and the country of Germany, he said, you fight to the death. Scorched earth. Burn everything. Let them get nothing. Tear everything down. Destroy everything. That is where human passion and human desire just implodes. Just caves in, and nothing matters. This is where our society and our people are moving toward, and that can seep into us. Not just in our day-to-day lives, but especially as we approach the holy days. Verse 14 again, then it was revealed in my hearing by the Lord of hosts, surely for this iniquity there will be no atonement for you, even to your death, says the Lord of hosts. As we approach it, trumpets, I pray that there is an atonement for us. This attitude God is not pleased with. He allows us to suffer the consequences of our actions so that we will learn and change. Yet all of our human nature is prone to pursue scorched earth. It's my way or the highway. We will ride our desires, if unbridled, brethren, we will ride our desires all the way to our graves. Or maybe our desires ride us. Unfortunately, this is the inevitable outcome of any approach to life that excludes God and God's perspective. Let's go back to Ecclesiastes and finish here in chapter 12. Chapter 12 is a remarkable chapter. Such incredible symbolism in this treatise that is here, verses 1 through 8. We used this as a camp theme last year to help our youth to focus on what really mattered. It describes in this section the human body breaking down, and he does so with very colorful terms. And you want to make sure that you've got the principles in your life established in God when you were young, so that when you're old, and you can't make those changes as early, and your mind doesn't work as well as it used to, and you don't have the strength in your arms or the ability to do what you would like to be able to do, at least you know in principle you are aligned with God. Now verses 9 through 14 is what I wanted to read. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he He still taught all the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright, words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. And further, my son, be admonished by these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study there is wearisome to the flesh. Let us conclude, or hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. It is in this ending that some infer that Solomon will be there in the kingdom. It's hard to tell. With all that he had done, it's difficult to know where he ended his life. But in penning this book, he gave us an understanding of where we need to look for meaning. Life has no meaning apart from God. Life is fulfilled only when we act in obedience to God as our creator and ruler, to understand his plan and to live it. All other human philosophies, anything else that we could endeavor to do, begin and end in the dust. Ecclesiastes teaches us that all indeed is vanity unless we make God the center of our lives. This book is about meaning and perspective. So as we approach the fall holy days, where will we search for meaning, specifically at the Feast of Tabernacles? What will be our perspective? At the feast, partially because of our increased wealth, it's easy to get overly involved in things that have no meaning to life and even push aside the lessons of the feast, even to a point of not attending a holy convocation that God has personally invited us to. We miss them because we want to do other things. Or we set our focus on things like food, restaurants, clothing, accommodations, rental cars, shopping, golf. These things, again, are not wrong of themselves. They are a very important part of the celebration God wants us to enjoy. It's his tithe he's given us. They're God's gifts. But they must not become the focus. We are commanded by God to celebrate and rejoice. But without God and his purpose at the center of it all, our celebration will be vain. It'll be empty. It'll be meaningless, a grasping for the wind. Though our dwellings at the feast will be temporary, the feast is a place to fulfill the longing for eternity that God put in every human heart. The difference is we get that. We get an opportunity to expand on that and make it part of us. That paradox doesn't enslave us as it did Solomon, as it does all of mankind. God opened our minds to know what we were meant to be, and he showed us the work very clearly that we need to be about to achieve that, to be there. When he tells us to spend his tithe on all our heart's desire, he wants to see our longing for eternity governing those desires. This is a godly perspective. This is a perspective above the sun. As a result, our lives are no longer empty, futile, and meaningless, and neither should be our Feast of Tabernacles. Our perspective cannot remain under the sun as Solomon's and the rest of the world's, or we will lose out on God's true meaning and purpose for the feast. It is, in fact, a celebration designed for those having a godly perspective above the sun.